Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today, on April 30th, 1870, the 15th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution was adopted by Congress. The 15th Amendment guarantees that the right of citizens of the United States shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. The 15th Amendment is the original Voting Rights Act, which should put original intent addicts as well as vote restriction promoters and gerrymandering politicians on notice that every attempt to deny anyone's qualification or opportunity to vote who is eligible to vote is patently unconstitutional and criminally illegal. I start today's program with a couple of narratives by Dr. Robert Brake of Ocean Park, Washington, who is a teacher, writer, and self-proclaimed advocate for peace. His two stories are stories within stories about war. I begin with War is a Racket. Really rich people, or corporations that define themselves as people, might argue that the biggest problem in America is, drum roll please, rich people are not rich enough. What they would not argue is that war is very profitable and a really major way to get richer. I have just reread a fascinating, timelessly relevant book written in 1935 called War is a Racket by United States Marine Corps Major General Smedley Darlington Butler. The title aptly describes Butler's attitude about war and the attendant profiteering that shameless opportunists sought way back. Butler's 79-page booklet provides specific dollar amounts generated by American corporations during World War I. While his calculations might seem a bit ballpark to some, he does clearly establish that warfare provides lucrative opportunities to businesses, often oblivious to the real costs of war: loss of loved ones, newly placed gravestones, mangled bodies, shattered minds, broken hearts and homes, not to mention collateral damage, PTSD, and other costs, such as the huge debt to be shouldered by current and future citizens. Using 1930s dollar values, Butler calculated that World War I cost the United States $51 billion, $400 for every American man, woman, and child. The Great War, as they called it then, yielded $16 billion in profits to munitions makers, shipbuilders, bankers, and a host of other businesses, plus speculators. Along the way, the Great War produced 21,000 new millionaires and billionaires, few of whom ever shouldered a rifle or dug a trench. Butler produced specific profit margins for corporations like DuPont, Bethlehem Steel, Anaconda, and many others that realized a 200% increase in profit during the war. That somber assessment was issued by one of the most decorated Marines in U.S. history, a 34-year veteran who participated in military actions in the Philippines, China, Central America, and the Caribbean, and commanded a debarkation and training base in France in World War I. By the end of his career, Butler, who was born in 1881 and died in 1940, had received 16 medals, 5 for heroism, and was one of 19 men to receive the Congressional Medal of Honor twice. Butler was well known as an outspoken critic of U.S. wars and their consequences. After retiring from the service, he became a popular activist, speaking at meetings organized by veterans, pacifists, and church groups in the 1930s. So Butler knew well of what he spoke. Consider the following remarks from a speech he delivered in 1933 to World War I veterans of the Bonus Army, demonstrating in Washington, D.C., 2 years prior to his articulation of similar indictments of war profiteers in his booklet, War is a Racket. War is just a racket. It is conducted for the benefit of the very few at the expense of the masses. I believe in adequate defense at the coastline and nothing else. If a nation comes over here to fight, then we'll fight. The trouble with America is that when the dollar only earns 6% over here, then it gets restless and goes overseas to get 100%. Then the flag follows the dollar, and the soldiers follow the flag. I wouldn't go to war again, as I have done, to protect some lousy investments of the bankers. There are only two things we should fight for. One is the defense of our homes, and the other is the Bill of Rights. War for any other reason is just a racket. During my 34 years of service, I spent most of my time being a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street, and for the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer, a gangster for capitalism. I helped make Mexico safe for American oil interests in 1914. I helped make Cuba a decent place for the National City Bank boys to collect revenues in. I helped in the raping of half a dozen Central American republics for the benefit of Wall Street. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for the American sugar interests in 1916. I helped make Honduras right for the American fruit companies in 1903. In China in 1927, I helped see to it that Standard Oil went on its way unmolested. Looking back on it, I might have given Al Capone a few hints. The best he could do was to operate his racket in three districts of Chicago. I operated on three continents. Reflecting on what it was like serving in the military, Butler proclaimed, "My mental faculties remained in suspended animation while I obeyed orders of higher-ups." Despite these self-incriminating remarks, however, Butler issued his trenchant condemnation of the profit motive behind warfare, and his 1935 booklet earned him much respect and acclaim from numerous organizations that opposed war. General Butler's suggestion to smash the war racket included three steps to be taken. The first, take the profit out of war by conscripting capital, industry, and labor before the government can draft the nation's youth for war. Two, permit the youth only who might be conscripted to bear arms to decide whether or not there should be war. And three, make certain that our military forces are employed for defense only. That was 80-plus years ago, but Butler's conclusions have remained relevant since. For example, in his January 17, 1961 farewell address, President Dwight D. Eisenhower warned that we must guard against acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. And that warning was issued by a five-star general, not a mere two-star general like Butler. Ike believed Americans had been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. How vast? Let's get current and consider the design and construction of just one aircraft carrier, the USS Gerald R. Ford, authorized in 2005, commissioned in 2013, and still not seaworthy. At just over $16 billion, the Gerald Ford is perhaps the most expensive boondoggle ship ever built. Recently regaled in battle jacket while standing on the Gerald Ford's deck, Donald Trump strongly advocated a $54 billion increase in our already swollen military budget. The Gerald Ford construction project has involved Lockheed Martin Corporation, the Boeing Aircraft Company, Northrop Grumman Corporation, and other corporations, none of which have paid federal taxes while reaping obscene profits. Here is what just one military expenditure we would pay for in today's dollars. $16 billion would equal the 2014 NASA budget. It would equal all the Hurricane Sandy relief funding, Exxon's record-smashing 2012 yearly profit, the Facebook purchase price of WhatsApp, and the yearly cost, estimated, of excessive alcohol ingestion in Texas. That is obscene, considering our dire need to repair America's infrastructure, the need for new schools and newly hired teachers, and the urgent need to clean up our environment in the throes of global warming. While Smedley Butler serves as a model of clear-headed thinking in the 1930s, I doubt that any of Trump's generals serving as cabinet members or advisors would or could muster that kind of honest appraisal of war today. Too bad. After all, it took a 54-year-old two-star general with 34 years of military experience to boldly end his 1935 anti-war booklet in all caps and an explanation point, "To hell with war." And that was War is a Racket by Dr. Robert Brake. And a second one by Dr. Brake, "Are We Hardwired for Violence?" Are we hardwired for violence? Some, like playwright Robert Ardrey and anthropologist Napoleon Chagnon, argue that as Cain's children, we have a natural predisposition for war that becomes highly destructive and a self-fulfilling prophecy, making war more likely. In certain circumstances, they assert, we have a predilection for violence, especially when there's high resource competition, territory, food, water, or social status. But others argue that there is no evidence whatever that human beings who are nonviolent eventually feel a need to commit mayhem. Indeed, there is abundant evidence that people are quite capable of renouncing war. As political activist Susan Sontag suggested, nobody can think and hit someone at the same time. And let's not forget that we humans also promote constructive social activities, including altruism, empathy, volunteerism, handicrafts, and tool making, and construction of animal shelters, food storage systems, and crop raising. Essayist and MacArthur Genius Grant fellow George Saunders framed it well when he eloquently tapped into a desire in all of us to lead kinder, more fulfilling lives. I recently reviewed three anti-war literary works that ponder the futility of violence. Here is what I rediscovered. Author Stephen Crane, just 23 when he penned The Red Badge of Courage, a powerful commentary on the futility of war, did not depict war as chivalric combat or a series of romantic adventures with a patriotic hero. Young recruit Henry Fleming first undergoes cowardice and flees a battlefield, then returns to courageously enter the battle, presumably at Chancellorsville, and earn his red badge. Crane dramatically depicts how the raw experience of combat affected Civil War soldiers, emotionally and psychologically. Red Badge is all about the problematic nature of courage under fire. Ambrose Bierce's Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge is a seamlessly perfect short story about a hanging during the Civil War. The victim, captured by Union troops, imagines his escape from the noose and ponders why he will be executed for no meaningful reason. Occurrence at Owl Creek offers another intriguing statement about the futility of war and its attendant violence. And Dalton Trumbull's 1939 novel and 1970 film and radio drama with James Cagney, Johnny Got His Gun, focuses on a young American who has his legs and arms blown off in World War I. He is kept alive but has no speech, sight, or hearing, and can only reflect on his sweetest teenage memories and philosophies upon why he was sent to war in the first place. While the film depicts only one sequence of actual battle, Johnny Got His Gun can stake a claim as every bit as morally motivated as such great anti-war films as All Quiet on the Western Front, Dr. Strangelove, Soldier Blue, Platoon, Born on the 4th of July, and Saints and Soldiers. The film demonstrates that as long as the unwalking wounded remain out of our eyes, and as long as patriotism is offered as a reason to be slaughtered on foreign soil, America's young will continue to be served up as sacrificial lambs on behalf of a more powerful hierarchy. Johnny Got His Gun is more than a soliloquy against war. It is a compelling movie about wasted youth, lessons unlearned, and the sheer immorality of sending someone into battle without giving a clear reason for why they are being sent. Albert Einstein advocated nonviolence when he said, "I believe that Gandhi's views were the most enlightened of all the political men of our time. We should strive to do things in his spirit, not to use violence in fighting our cause, but by non-participation in anything you believe is evil." And that was Einstein. Cognitive scientist and psychologist Steven Pinker and others believe that despite our frequently violent behavior, we humans may slowly be on track toward building a more peaceable future. Pinker's data show that humans are slowly getting better at living together, though you couldn't tell that to Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, or to Native Americans in North Dakota, or to Black Americans in metropolitan America, or to Latinos threatened with deportation, or to Muslims seeking refuge from violence in their home countries. There is a story, said to be of Cherokee origin, that perhaps speaks well to this matter. a young girl was troubled by a recurring dream in which two wolves fought viciously with each other. When she recounted the dream to her grandfather, a village elder renowned for his wisdom, he explained that there are two wolves inside everyone, one peaceful and one warlike. At this, the girl was even more upset and asked, "Which one wins?" Her grandfather's response, "The one you feed." And that was by Robert Brake, as a matter of fact, two by Robert Brake. This one, "Are We Hardwired for Violence?" And now, one from me. A brief respite from perpetual war. Late spring or early summer, when the ground is dry and hard, is traditionally the season when winter restless armies clash. It is almost a contradiction. When life is renewed, armies sharpen their spears, load their cannon. But perhaps men make war because they are unable to give birth, the continuing winter of their discontent. Winter's soldiers. "There is no good war and no bad peace," Ben Franklin said. But peace has also been defined as a period between wars, a time to bury the dead, lick wounds, produce new weapons, and recruit more human fodder. As with most other effects of insatiable technology, warfare has advanced far beyond nature's strictures of weather or geography. The world's militaries, even the poorest from the most obscure nation, are able to make war any time, any place. State-of-the-art weapons float around the world, sold by arms merchants to anyone with money, good credit, or good prospects. The industrial nations are arms bazaars, producing and marketing exotic weapons and ultra-weapons systems, vicariously enraptured by the increased carnage rockets and jet fighter bombers make of tribal-level squabbles. Perhaps abstract engagement in wars fought by others, made possible by outlandish weapons designed somewhat in the manner of video games, is evidence of a postmodern sensibility of image over participation. This de facto decadence might be related to the hallucinatory dread of nuclear obliteration, which is almost too large a horror to bear. It seems almost incomprehensible that humanity has made itself capable of its own extinction, that by our own will we can disappear from history as absolutely as dinosaurs and dodo birds. Most people refuse to think we could be so foolish, yet they suspect our leaders have few qualms or sufficient fear. In such a world, reality hurts. We turn away as we would from a glare of sunlight. We submerge into banality to mute our anxieties. Genesis might be a warning. Instead of a myth of instant birth, it is a prophecy of sudden mega-death. Perhaps we are still in the garden, it being a metaphor for life. Evil might not be sex after all, or knowledge, but humanity's careless brutality that leads irresistibly toward plucking the ripe fruit of specicide. The poets might be right after all. The prospect of peace is more irrational than the dark, brooding desire for murder each of us hosts like a malevolent gene. Humanity's penchant for sinister error, folly, mass psychosis, and loathsome horror gives us our sense of humor, our appreciation of the comedy of inescapable death. The only real significance of the eternal conflicts of our species is the epic amount of blood, the slaughter of millions at every turn of history's gory pages, for reasons as brief as their lives. The names of the multitudes are lost, only their numbers are marked, aggregates of killers and killed. Humanity's history is of wars. The most fierce and acquisitive sweep away the gentle and least avaricious. It was that way when our hairy ancestors thrust pointed sticks into each other. It is that way now when the weapons of our industry are able to reduce continents to radioactive ash in minutes. We are a killing species. We rule Earth because our ancestors were clever, ruthless, and well-organized predators, and we have always butchered our own as readily as any other creature. We kill individually, which is murder, or we organize murder and name it war. We have throughout history honored the killers among us, and as we become more settled and civilized, the laurels inevitably transferred from stealthy hunters of animals to the slayers of human beings. All of our great civilizations and empires have been structured on the conquest, and often decimation, of tribes, cities, or nations unlucky to be along the march of more ambitiously militant societies. War has advanced civilization as brutally as it has destroyed civilizations. Humanity is as accustomed to warfare as breathing or copulation. Our mental evolution of the past 10,000 years has not eradicated the savagery or the terror of our most primitive ancestors. We continue to regard every other human, and by extension, other cultures, nations, religions, and races as our blood enemies. We continue to war or think of war as our right to dominate or destroy whoever is weaker, different, or in the way. We refuse to think of ourselves as parts of the same family or to understand the rarity or privilege of life. We make excuses for warfare and accept it as a consequence of living. We seldom think of war as our invention. We treat it instead as a natural phenomenon, an earthquake, a flood, or volcano. We feed its insatiable thirst for blood with the best blood stock that we produce. War is never necessary, and there has never been a good war, only bad wars that compel a tribe, a city, a nation to defend itself against the ruthless ambitions of an eager enemy. The possibility of war with Islam, the cradle of civilization, is an ironic symbol that humanity is threatening the future by never getting past the conflicts of its earliest superstitions, which originated from the most elemental questions pertaining to life and purpose, but have been frozen in mutually savage dogmas like fossils in ice. Every war can be traced back centuries, a vengeful apathy beneath a contemporary surface of conflict, religious at its root. The most devastating and never forgiven wars are religiously based, holy wars, crusades, jihads, whatever they may be called, and it seems that every century has an explosive recurrence among the same theological adversaries. And now, the world is at a millennium of a religiously bifurcated calendar. The cusps of millenniums seem to stir apocalyptic prophecies to greater carnage to obliterate opposing theologies. The last millennium, in 1000 AD, sparked holy wars that lasted three centuries and have never really ceased. Human antipathy does not go away easily or for very long. Old hatreds scab over only briefly and soon re-erupt. History seldom mentions compassion as an object of concern or as a vital ingredient to the structure of civilization. Inhumanity is exclusively human. Demonizing an enemy is common and ancient. The enemy are vermin or subhuman and represent ant-like civilizations offensive to the true God and national interests. Decimation of the enemy is the goal. Dehumanizing the enemy is the policy. Extermination is the method. It would be a grotesque irony that humanity might perish because it is unable to resolve conflicts from its earliest history, hopelessly mired in the irredeemable past and thus patently self-destructing its future. Perhaps as summer approaches, armed horsemen on some grassy steppe are mounting. An army masses near an unsuspecting border. An insurrection prepares to topple a government. A newly established nuclear power readies to flex it at old enemies. Soldiers and robotic drones act as our ambassadors. We seem to be at perpetual war. Yet though we await Armageddon, we grasp at any moment of peace. Instead of holding our breath, we should breathe easier when it appears. Like this season of spring, it will probably be brief, but any soldier will tell you, a lifetime can be packed into the nanoseconds between bullets. Waiting for the next shot, however, can affect the nerves. And an epilogue. Donald Trump's ardent desire is to be a war president. He is remaking the United States into a military police regime like Benito Mussolini, who established his fascist party in Italy this month in 1919, barely 5 months after the end of World War I. Trump presumably requested troops, tanks, and missiles for his inaugural parade, but the Pentagon balked. He could imitate G.W. Bush and strut around in a personally tailored uniform, burnished with bright medals of his Art of the Deal triumphs, and preside over huge war rallies on the scale of Adolf Hitler. Trump's virtual elimination of truth and veracity, his disfiguring of democratic society into a gulag state of imprisoned immigrants and refugees awaiting deportation, while alienating nearly every other nation with his self-obsessed America First isolationist jingoism, have suddenly and unnecessarily made the world a much more dangerous place for everybody. Trump sternly boasts of the need for the U.S. to demonstrate so-called hard power in foreign relations, which seems to be an impulsive, schoolyard, masturbatory fantasy with grotesquely possible results. For example, he bullies, just short of war, North Korea's nasty young emperor, who resembles in temperament and vanity a Trump clone. Perhaps we might think of these two nuclear toy boy adversaries as Fat Man versus Little Boy, take your pick as to who is who, which were the names of the two atomic bombs dropped on Japan 72 years ago. So now we, Oregon coast dwellers, must wait for an additional possible doom. We play roulette for which might be the winner of the race of our probable fates, the long-anticipated Cascadia earthquake and tsunami, or the eventuality of North Korean nukes capable of reaching North America's west coast. Maybe we can get odds at one of Trump's failed casinos. Edwin Starr said it all in a song half a century ago. War, what is it good for? Absolutely nothing. This has been Michael McCusker. Yesterday was Vietnam Veterans Day in the USA. Hallelujah. Glory. Hallelujah.